Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami.
So as I said before the meditation that I've been involved this afternoon with children and other people organising our Indian Ocean map, which we hope to fill with loving hearts and helping hands through your donations. And it's been lovely to work with the children. The idea of doing a fundraising with the children was to give the young ones the opportunity to participate in doing something for the people who've suffered as a result of the tsunami. Very often, when tragedy strikes, when things need to be done, children feel tremendous pull of the heart, tremendous feeling of sadness and compassion and wanting to do something, but they don't always have the opportunity to do that. The adults are busy, the adults are doing things, but the children haven't got a way of sharing in that helping and haven't got a way of giving vent to their feelings. And so we thought it would be nice to do something that gave the children the opportunity to participate and put in their time and energy and express their concern for the people who've suffered so drastically. And the Buddhist Society, as you're probably aware, is composed of people from all over the world, but particularly from all over the Buddhist world. And so we're aware of the fact that this tragedy has touched many of our members directly. And just as those members wanted to express their concern and do something practically for the people who've suffered, we realised that it wasn't just a matter of across cultures, it was also across ages. And so that's why we've been so pleased with being able to work with the children today. This response of the heart, which is moved by the suffering of others and which then wants to do something to be of help, to be of service, this is a very natural part of being a human being. And it's been wonderful to see the response around the world to the victims of the tsunami. Very often we dwell on the negative aspects of human nature, and we don't very often get an opportunity to rejoice in the good qualities that all of us have and that every human being has the potential for. So this tragedy has been wonderful to the extent that it's been able to give people the opportunity to express their wish for the end of suffering. As we look around the world, we see, of course, not only the people who've been affected by the tsunami suffering, but many other groups of people in many other kinds of situations. So we don't want to just focus on the tsunami victims all the time, but it's very worthwhile to focus our attention on a particular group, on a particular situation, at the time when it's really going to make a difference. But, of course, In Buddhism, we're also looking not only at the action that's being done, the good that's being done by whatever generosity we can display, not only the good that's done for the other people, but the good that it does for ourselves. When we think about this particular tragedy or any of the tragedies around the world or any of the tragedies that we know personally or maybe the tragedy in our own life at this moment, the Buddhist perspective is to look outwards but to also look inwards and to see what arises in our own heart in response to whatever it is that we are experiencing. So we notice when the mind is moved with generosity. We notice what moves the mind. We notice the feeling of often happiness that comes in being able to feel a deeper connection with other beings that we might otherwise not feel so close to. We may not even know about them. And then all of a sudden we see that they're just like me. And in that seeing and the movement of the heart, there is, as well as the sadness in their suffering, there's a wonderful opening, a wonderful energy that arises, a positive energy that comes from that connection. And then the next movement that says, well, what can I do to help? We notice that. And we notice when the mind says, oh, that's too much, or that's going too far, or that's enough. We notice what limits whatever it is that we feel like doing, feel moved to do, think we can do. We notice when the doors slam shut again and how that feels, that cutting off, that closing down. And this isn't to become negative or fault-finding with ourselves, but just to notice this tug of war that goes on in the heart, this sense of boundaries and how they persist. They might be pushed down temporarily, they might be dissolved for a while, but then they re-arise. And with our mindfulness, paying attention to what's going on, we feel that in the heart. We hear those voices in the mind that explain why we can only do this or why we can't do that. Maybe we hear the voice that's saying, do a bit more, and then the voice that says, yes. And we push ourselves beyond what is comfortable, beyond what we would normally do. And then we feel what that's like when we stretch the heart even further. And then we might again stretch that little bit further and wait to feel what it's like. We might be surprised. What is it like? We might find our satisfaction tinged with disappointment. Gee, it didn't really make that much difference. Or no one really knows what I did. Or does it really matter anyway? Very often we hear our negative conditioning coming back, undermining what we've done. We can learn a lot about ourselves and our conditioning by paying attention to the mind as it goes through these kinds of twists and turns. We learn a lot about boundaries and our sense of self. And in this practice, it's always about staying awake, keeping open, so we can learn, so we can start to see clearly, and so we can also discern for ourselves what truly brings happiness and what truly brings misery. We can only discover this for ourselves. Each one of us will have our own particular limitations for whatever conditioning we've been exposed to in our life, for whatever we've experienced personally. And in this practice, what we're trying to do is not to be judgmental about ourselves and not to be judgmental about others, but to really discover what it means fully to be human. When we are exposed to tragedies, to natural occurrences like the tsunami, we very often feel overwhelmed that there's nothing we can do to stop that kind of thing. Our life can feel quite vulnerable, quite fragile. We can notice that kind of fear that comes up. Sometimes we don't want to notice too much of what's going on because it produces too much fear about our own situation. This is something that we also can become aware of, how we close down almost in anticipation before anything drastic has happened, just in case it might happen. We wonder what we could do to prepare ourselves for meeting this kind of huge catastrophe. Well, in the Buddha's teaching, we're reminded again and again that each one of us one day will meet that huge catastrophe. One day each one of us will die in some way. One day each one of us will be faced with those final moments. So this is an aspect of our experience of being human that is very much central to Buddhist practice. And when we think, well, I can't do anything to stop these natural disasters, we're right. The natural disaster of death will certainly come sometime, somewhere. But there is something that we can do to be ready. There is something that we can do to be prepared. And this is what the path of practice is about. Tonight I'd like to use the analogy of the bushfire as a way of seeing how we can, through our understanding of the situation we're facing, the danger that we're facing, be prepared. And through being prepared, very often deal with the situation skillfully. It's a very apt topic, bushfires, because we're in the middle of the bushfire season and the nuns' monastery is in the middle of the bush. So it's not just theory for us. We're very much concerned about our bushfire preparedness. And in my reading about bushfires and trying to be prepared and to be trained and ready to meet that possible disaster, one of the things which I've discovered is that there are things that you can do even if a bushfire comes. If we don't know what we're dealing with, then very often we think there's nothing that we can do. It's a hopeless situation. And we feel even more overwhelmed. We feel even less able to cope. Just the thought that it might come is enough to unnerve us. But there are things that one can do. And if one understands the nature of the fire and the bushfire, be prepared and act in a proactive way to protect oneself. And this is like the path of practice that we have to protect ourselves even though death will certainly come. The way that we meet our death and the way that we're able to deal with the circumstances of our death can be prepared for. That's what we do in our practice. So if we think about a bushfire coming and the fact that we live in a bushfire-prone area, in a forest, the first thing in terms of relating this experience to our situation in life is to understand that all of us live in the forest. All of us live in the forest of greed, hatred, and delusion. And all of us have the potential to burn because of our defilements, because of our self-centered way of approaching life, which gives rise to speaking and acting in greedy, angry, irritable ways. This is like acknowledging in the monastery, well, we live in the middle of the forest. There is danger around and we've got to do something about it. It's no good just turning a blind eye. And this is the starting point for our practice. We live in the forest. So we live in the forest of the defilements and we're likely to get burned at any time. So instead of turning a blind eye, we turn towards the work that needs to be done. And the Buddha has given us very precise instructions on what needs to be done and also how to understand this fire that flares up. In many ways, the Buddha talked about the world burning with craving, burning with desire. And so the starting point is, yes, we're in the middle of the forest and fire can come at any time. Now, on a bush block, it's a legal requirement that every year we do fire breaks. So we have to hire someone with a tractor or a front-end loader and come in to put in the fire breaks. And because we live on a very big property, we have to have extra wide fire breaks at our boundaries and then 3 metre wide fire breaks throughout the property to cut it up into smaller sections that can be managed if they burn. And the idea is that the fire breaks don't stop a fire coming in. They might if it's a small fire, but they give us access to the areas that are burning. They give the firefighters access to the areas that are burning. Now, in the spiritual life, the boundaries that we have around our speech and our behaviour are the 5 precepts. Not to harm living beings, not to take what is not given, not to engage in sexual misconduct, not to speak in a dishonest way, and not to take drugs and alcohol which confuse the mind. These are the boundaries that we set around our speech and behaviour. These are the limits we say we don't go beyond this. Now, the interesting thing about the fire breaks is that they don't really stop the fire, but they give access to where the fire might be. And with the precepts, when we take the precepts and make a commitment to keeping them, unless we work with those precepts again and again and again, we find that they don't stop the fire of greed, hatred, and delusion breaking out and expressing itself in our speech and our action. When we get tempted enough, when we get pushed enough, we'll find that we break those precepts. If we take them in a legalistic way, because that's what we do as Buddhists, as though we are going to be saved because we've taken the precepts, then we're going to find that they don't actually protect us. For the precepts to protect us, we have to keep contemplating, what do they offer me? How do they support me? How do they help me to live the kind of life that I want to live? How do they help me to purify the mind? How do they help me to see more clearly what's going on in my own mind? If we use the precepts in this way, we might examine which precepts are difficult to keep and which are easy. In what circumstances is this one easy to keep but hard to keep? What sort of company am I in when I find I have to break that precept, otherwise I don't fit in any longer? This is the way we examine our experience around the precepts so that we learn about ourselves. If we just keep them in a legalistic way, it's like putting the fire breaks around the property and expecting that that's enough. We're going to be safe now that we've done what we legally have to do. But of course, we know that's not the case. When we keep the precepts and we reflect on them and we investigate them again and again, as soon as we have the impulse in the mind arising to do something which is against the precepts, we are awake in that moment. It's like we've got the fire break there, and so we can get to the fire. It's obvious. We can get there. We can see it. Because what I'm about to say, what I'm about to do, what I'm planning goes against the precepts which I've committed myself to uphold. And so we see quite directly what's going on in our experience. An example I was giving recently to someone was the idea that we have, if we live by the rules, if we do things according to the requirements, then we expect that everything will go all right. It's not fair if we try to do the right thing and it doesn't work out. We might be the sort of person who is always honest, always parks within the lines in the parking lot, never takes up someone else's place, always does the right thing, and yet someone else comes along and steps on our toes. Or we make all the right applications, all the right moves, and then we still don't get our desired result. And we think, that's not fair. What's the point of being good if you can't get what you want? What's the point of keeping precepts? That's sort of the legalistic approach. But the contemplative approach is to say, well, what do I get? What do I get personally out of doing things according to the rules? How does it help me? And we notice that when we follow the rules, when we do things in an orderly way, in the way that we're supposed to, that there's much less confusion in the mind. We don't have to try and double guess what would be the best way. How can I get it done? How can I go in the back door? Who can I be nice to get what I want? When we're straight, when we do it as it should be done, the mind has much less turmoil, much less confusion, much less inner friction. And this is the benefit of doing things according to the rules, regardless of the result that comes our way. When we investigate the inner experience, we see the benefit. And this is how we develop the confidence that keeping precepts is a worthwhile thing. Keeping precepts is beneficial in its own way, for its own sake. Not just because it's what we're meant to do. Like having the fire breaks because that's a legal requirement. We recognise it's actually beneficial to be able to get to the fire quickly. Now the next thing about bushfires is that when a fire is coming, it comes obviously when it's hot and when the wind is strong. That's when it's most dangerous. But the interesting thing about bushfires is that they create their own wind. They create their own heat. And when I reflect this is like when the defilements are present in the mind. Once the emotions start to get stirred up, once we start to keep thinking about something that we want or something that's upset us, something that we get very involved with, the experience of that, no matter how it started, is that we get more and more flustered, more and more agitated. Sometimes a bushfire can start through natural causes like lightning strike. Sometimes because someone is careless and throws away a lit cigarette. Or sometimes deliberately, someone, as we've seen recently, deliberately sets fires. And so in our own life, we might have that experience. There might be firebugs in our family, firebugs in our relationships. That is the people who deliberately stir us up. They know our soft spots. They know when to say or do something that will really get us riled. And we can think of them like the firebugs. But we also have natural occurrences that stir us up. Maybe there's something that's not too big an issue, but because we're very tired or because we've had a difficulty in some other area of our life, say we've had a bad day at the office, we've been working really hard, the boss doesn't appreciate us, and we come home and people at home aren't interested in how badly we're feeling that day, they're full of their own stuff, and little by little we find ourselves burning up. Just naturally, not through any particular person deliberately goading us, but just through the building up of natural events. And once we start to get fired up, we create our own heat and our own wind. We can notice how disturbed the mind can get around seemingly insignificant things. And particularly the more we play with it, the more we think about it, the more we get stirred up, even if no one else is egging us on. And this is what happens with fires. They start small, but they get bigger and bigger. They build up their own momentum. And we can notice this in our own life, particularly if when something starts in the present, it starts to call on unfinished business from the past, then we find we've got a lot of fuel for that fire and it just gets hotter and hotter. How do we work with this kind of situation in our life? Well, forewarned. When we practice particularly keeping precepts and we have a closer scrutiny of our speech and our behaviour, we see when things are starting to get out of control. When we practice meditation, we become much more sensitive to those inner changes. We can be in touch with even the slightest change, and certainly once we get really het up, we're aware of how that feels and how unpleasant it feels. We're aware of the damage that we're doing to ourselves. We need to be mindful, to pay attention. Again, not to what it's doing to someone else, but what it's doing to ourselves. This is where the practice always comes back to our own experience, the harm that we're doing to ourselves. And we notice sometimes that we just get more and more and more caught up. And it seems like we can't stop it. It has a momentum of its own, a life of its own. And even though we know it's going to burn us, we just can't stop. And we let it take its course. Unless we catch it early, unless we're aware of the danger, unless we deal with it when it's manageable, then it's going to be a wildfire that gets out of control. Now, in a real bushfire, when a fire started and it starts to spread with its own heat and its own wind, the sparks that come from the fire travel ahead of the main blaze, and they can arrive somewhere half an hour before the actual blaze arrives. And so, particularly if you're trying to protect your property, you have to be aware of the fact that those sparks are the real danger. In a property that is well prepared, one can usually fight the fire. A well-prepared property has anything flammable removed from around the walls of the house, anything that's likely to burn removed from the immediate vicinity of the house. The house is shut up, all the doors and windows are blocked. And before the fire comes, you wet down the roof, fill the gutters till they overflow, and wet down all the surrounding areas. Because it's the shower of sparks that comes along and ignites whatever is flammable on the wall around the property that starts the first fires, even before the main blaze arrives. Those sparks enter the house through the roof, through the open windows, through the door, and they ignite what's inside the house long before the main fire comes. And so if you're preparing to meet the blaze, you have to be prepared at that point to meet those sparks. Now, in terms of the practice and the Buddha's teaching, one of the very important strategies that we have for defending our mind is called guarding the senses. The Buddha pointed out, and you can experiment with this for yourself, that in order for the mind to arise, there has to be some kind of stimulation through one of the senses, through seeing something, through hearing something, through smelling something, through tasting something, through feeling something with the body, or thinking about it. Every time we come in contact with something, that produces a reaction in the mind. Now, when we are boiling, when there's already a fire burning, whether it's a fire of greed or a fire of hatred, it's because we've seen something, heard something, smelt something, tasted something, touched something, or thought about something, and that has triggered a reaction in the mind. If we don't protect the mind from further stimulation of the same kind, then that fire is going to get stronger. It's like those showers of sparks. They're only tiny, but they do a lot of damage, especially when the mind isn't protected, especially when we leave the doors and windows open, especially when we've already got a lot of flammable material inside, in the mind. Those sparks, small, apparently not so drastic, but they come in and they set things on fire. So guarding the senses means that we withdraw from those people, those situations, those things which are giving rise to our inner reactions. And it may not be something that is making us angry. It could be something, for example, that's making us sad. Now someone, many people in fact, have said to me how sad they've been watching the images on the television of the devastation after the tsunami. It's brought them to tears. But in that situation, we have to be very careful about protecting the mind. Yes, it's important to see what's going on, and it's wonderful that we're touched by the suffering of others, but we don't have to keep looking again and again and again and subjecting the mind to the kind of stimulation that makes it feel sad and sad and sad and sad and sad. We have to draw a line. We have to guard the senses, because in guarding the senses, we guard the mind. One of the other things that the Buddha pointed out, which we can experiment with and investigate, is that the kind of mind that arises is not according to our wishes, according to our will. We can't make sadness go and happiness arise if what we're feeding the mind is sad images again and again and again. What is produced is sadness, if we've got sadness in the mind. If we want to change the colour of the mind, we have to change what we are putting into it. We can't just watch images of sadness that provoke sadness again and again and again and expect to be feeling happy. This is the understanding of non-self. This mind arises dependent on causes and conditions, not according to our wishes and desires. So what we feed the mind produces the mind. And that's why it's so important to guard the senses. Every time those sparks shower us, we have to cut them off. We have to close up the doors and windows. We have to make sure those sparks don't get inside and start burning. Once they get inside, it's hard to put out the fire. Before the fire comes, we wet down the house, we wet down the area around the house, so that with that wetness, it's very hard for the fire to take hold. Now, in our life, that is like the cultivation of goodness. All of the acts of goodness, kindness, generosity, cultivating honesty, cultivating courage, determination, cultivating willingness to forgive, willingness to accept people as they are, all of those acts of mind and body which stretch us and help us to develop as a human being. This is like the wetting down of the flames. This is like giving rise to coolness so that fire can't ignite anything. And just like in the preparedness for the bushfire, it's no good waiting until the fire is there. We have to be proactive. We have to wet down before the fire reaches us. And this is why it's so important in the Buddha's path to cultivate what is good, to make the mind bright, strong. A happy mind is a strong mind. A bright mind can see more clearly. It can act before disaster strikes. A bright mind has more energy to challenge the defilements, more energy to go out and do more good. So it's indispensable if we want to be prepared for life, prepared for whatever life throws up to us, that we have to spend time and energy cultivating what is good, strengthening what is wholesome in our mind. Now, it was lovely today to see the young children coming along to colour in the flags of all the countries that had been affected by the tsunami, to trace round their hands and cut out their hands so they could put their helping hands together on the map to help the people who've been affected by the tsunami. But it was also wonderful to see their parents coming along to make it possible for the young children to be there. We had children from 1.5 years up to 77 years of age. All ages of little kids, middle kids and big kids. And we had such a wonderful time working together. Now, the elder ones, the older ones, the adults of us, we could choose to come. We could decide, yes, we'll make the effort. But those children had no way of coming unless their parents decided this is something worth doing. I'm going to put myself out. Some of the parents or the aunties actually took time off work so that their kids could come and participate. And the kids were just delightful. We were there from 2 o'clock in the afternoon and all the kids had their heads down and worked until almost 5 o'clock. We stopped for a break for about 20 minutes and one of the kids said, 20 minutes? That's a long time. I thought, 20 minutes? Oh, I wish we could have half an hour. But they didn't want to stop. They were having such a good time. And so were we. Now, this is the wonderful example. Not only the parents saying, yes, you should do this, you should do that, it would be nice, but the parents taking the trouble, coming along and colouring in, cutting out, doing all the work as well, showing the kids that they were enjoying doing it as well. Now, this is where it really makes an impact on young minds. And it makes an impact on our mind when we see how willing these young ones are to put themselves out, to participate, to do what they can to be helpful. Now, this is like dousing the area, the flammable area, with water. We give ourselves the protection of the cool mind, the happy mind, the full heart. And then whatever we have to deal with in life is not quite so difficult, not quite so bad. Not to say that there won't be heartache, but we'll start to see it as not just our own misery. We start to see that everyone has their share of misery in this life. Or maybe this misery, which we would have thought is just terrible, isn't that bad after all, when we look around and see what other people have to live with. So this is wetting the area before the flames come. Now, in the bushfire, when the sparks come, as I said, we have to protect the property by closing up, shutting down, and bringing inside anything that might burn. Of course, we want to get rid of the leaves and the rubbish, but we all have a lot of things outside on the verandas. We have our outdoor furniture. We have our hanging pots, all of those things which can catch a spark and ignite. And we have to remove them before the fire gets here. And when I contemplate what this is in our life, it seems to me that all of us have a lot of things out on our verandas that can catch sparks very easily. All of our views and opinions, all of our ideas about this or that, all of our fixed assumptions about this one or that one, all of our ideas about who I am, what I can do, what I can't do, what I'll let you do, our prejudices, all of those things which we hang out and dangle around and which very often lead to fire. We're a sitting duck very often because of our strongly held ideas or of our attachments, the things that we can't do without, things that we have to have. We can't get rid of those things. We need them, and so we keep them out there on our veranda. We don't put them away, and when the sparks fly, there's plenty of places where those sparks can land. So again, we examine, how is it that conflict arises? What happens when I get so attached to this or that? How much do I open myself up to conflict, discord, to the fire moving from just being a spark to being something that's out of control? So we try to contemplate all of those things we were attached to. Not the thing itself, but the attachment. What does that give rise to? Does it give rise to happiness? What kind of happiness? Deep happiness? Lasting happiness? Superficial happiness? Better than this? Not as good as that? We examine all of it and see, what can we do without? What can we put away? What do we not need to have dangling around in our life? How can we remove some of our vulnerability to fire? Again, this is something that we can only arrive at through contemplation, contemplating our own experience and investigating what arises as a result of our attachments, either to things or to our attitudes and views. Once we've closed up shop, taken in the things that could burn easily, then we have to wait for the fire front to come. And when the fire front comes, it's scary. It's noisy, it's hot, we're not quite sure whether we're safe. And at that moment, very often people panic and they try to outrun the fire. They leave the safety, the relative safety of their house, and they expose themselves to the fire, not realizing how hot the fire is, even if you can't see it. And very often they burn. And this is what happens to us very often. When we're trying to practice and trying to contain the fire and trying to keep on top of our emotions, trying to keep on top of our ideas, and yet when we get right into the heart of it, we lose our control. We lose that sense of safety, that sense of refuge, and we try to run away. Often we run right into the flames. That is, we lose it completely. In our speech and our behaviour, we don't act according to our own best interests. And so when that happens, once we've regrouped, often once it happens, we can't do anything until it's over. We lose it so badly that we can't stop it in mid-action. What we have to do is look back and learn from that situation. How was it that I didn't feel safe enough? Was I really prepared? Had I done my homework? Had I produced the kind of refuge, the cool place, the place where I can confidently go in the time of troubles? When we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and when we take the five precepts, we are setting up the conditions for producing a cool place, a safe refuge in our life. But we have to work at making that refuge truly safe. And we do that, as I've said, by not adhering to the precepts in a legalistic way, not thinking that we've done our job just because we've repeated them, but constantly investigating them. Not just letting things happen, but using our mindfulness and our present moment awareness to be in touch with what's happening while it's still only a spark before it gets into a raging fire. When we know that we're in trouble, we have to pull in our senses, we have to guard the senses, we have to protect ourselves from going any deeper into this mess. And we have to actively cultivate the things which will help to make the mind strong enough, calm enough, and clear enough to do what needs to be done before it's too late. This is a process that takes constant vigilance and constant effort. And when we find that we've lost it, when we haven't managed to maintain our refuge, we don't give up, we don't lose heart, we just use that experience to help us become wiser next time. And becoming wiser doesn't mean just waiting for the next fire. It means doing the work necessary to create the kind of refuge we need before the next fire comes along. When we think that we can't stop nature, we're right. But if we think that there's nothing that we can do to prepare when nature strikes, we're wrong. The Buddhist path, the path of practice, is about facing up to the facts of life, the reality of life, the reality of death, and doing what we can to be ready when death comes, in whatever form, at whatever time. So I encourage all of you to take heart. This is a path that is doable, and it produces tremendous results, even if we can't change the nature of life itself. We can learn to live at peace with the nature of life. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of us, and may it help us all to attain Nibbana. Does anyone have any questions or comments? So if there are no comments or questions, I'd like to finish there and...